His Hands and His Feet, an Easter sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
Dear sinner, dear doubter, dear skeptic, see His hands and feet. The forgiveness of my sin lies in the hands and the feet of the crucified and risen Jesus.
And we'll send you a CD of this sermon for any size gift during the Easter season. Make a secure online donation today, issuesetc.org. Thanks for thinking of us during the 50 days of Easter.
I am somebody who believes that women should have the ability to make often very difficult decisions about their own bodies and issues of reproduction. I will say the same thing that every president has said since this issue came up, which is I don't have litmus tests around any of these issues, but I will say that I want somebody who is going to be interpreting our Constitution in a way that takes into account individual rights, and that includes women's rights. And that's going to be something that's very important to me, because I think part of what our core constitutional values promote is the notion that individuals are protected in their privacy and their bodily integrity, and women are not exempt from that.
That's President Obama speaking yesterday to reporters about no litmus test. Now, every president says this. He's right. No litmus test. And yet, are there code words? Is there something to be parsed out of what the president says about what he wants by way of a replacement for John Paul Stevens on the U.S. Supreme Court and the nominee that he will name and the Senate will consider? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Thursday afternoon, April the 22nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to spend the first half hour talking to Colleen Carroll Campbell about four issues: President Obama's comments on the abortion litmus test, Pope Benedict pledging yesterday to confront the clerical sexual abuse scandal. That's good news. Treatment of those suffering from dementia, and we'll talk about what Tiger Woods and the rest of us can learn from Masters golf champion Phil Mickelson and the way he received his accolades after winning that championship. That's with Colleen Carroll Campbell here for the first half hour. And then in the second half hour, I got a question for you, and I want your answer for it. It stems from our first conversation, our first question with Colleen Carroll Campbell. Do you think that there should be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees? Yes? Why? No? Why not? I want to hear from you in 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. 1-877-623-MY-IE. Email us talkback at issuesetc.org or Twitter us at issuesetc. Colleen Carroll Campbell is a weekly columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of the book The New Faithful, and she hosts a radio and television program called Faith and Culture. Colleen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What did you make of the president's statement on a litmus test or no on the Supreme Court nominee he is going to be naming soon?
Well, I thought it was a curious statement. He begins by saying he has no litmus test, and he acknowledges that other presidents have also said they have no litmus test. Then he goes on to say that he expects to find someone who interprets the Constitution, he said, in a way that takes into account individual rights, including women's rights, which we know tends to be a euphemism for the right to abortion, and certainly in this context was. And he mentions that he wants a justice who's going to uphold the right to privacy, especially when it comes to a woman and her bodily integrity. Again, we know the right to privacy is something that was unearthed only in Roe v. Wade, an emanation of a penumbra of the Constitution. In other words, it's not in there. And so this basically was an invented right, and opponents of legalized abortion have always believed that and fought that. And so when the president says, no litmus test on abortion, but you have to believe in the right to privacy, he's basically saying there will be a litmus test on abortion.
Okay. It is traditional, I think, that presidents at least claim when talking to prospective Supreme Court nominees, whether they're pro-life or pro-choice, to say, well, we're not going to discuss abortion. It's not appropriate, and of course they can't speak about future cases that they may hear. So we're just going to leave that subject out. Do you expect the president to abide by that tradition?
Well, I think he's probably smart enough to do that. I mean, that's certainly a way to avoid any trouble, and then no one has to lie later to the press when they are asked if the subject came up. However, he can ask about the right to privacy, as we've mentioned before, and you can just look at most of these candidates' records to get a pretty clear sense of where they're coming from. Unfortunately, the legal profession more and more, and certainly our law schools, are controlled by people who are staunchly in favor of legalized abortion, usually abortion on demand with virtually no legal limits. And so it tends to be more the exception than the rule when President Obama goes looking at the ranks of those he would be considering, that he would stumble upon a pro-lifer. I think it's probably pretty unlikely. And given his view of the judicial system in general, I think it's unlikely he's going to choose an originalist, someone who actually interprets the Constitution rather than legislating from the bench. Unfortunately, he seems to prefer judicial activists and those who lean to the left. So I don't think he's going to have to discuss abortion to make sure he gets someone on the bench who will uphold Roe v. Wade.
Just so we're clear with our kind of euphemisms on both sides, if the right to privacy is, or a women's rights or something like that, is the euphemism for pro-choice, how would you respond to someone who says, well, you know, people, President George W. Bush and other pro-life presidents also have a euphemism called strict constructionist?
Well, I think the difference is you can actually look at the Constitution, what's there, and you can look at the laws that these judges are interpreting. And a strict constructionist, it's true, will not find a right to privacy, but that's simply because it doesn't exist in the Constitution. So does judicial originalism or strict constructionism lead to a suspicion of rulings like Roe v. Wade? Yes, it does, and that is fair. And, you know, would pro-lifers be as excited about strict constructionism if it didn't lead to a pro-life conclusion? Maybe not. But I think it's a very good thing for our democracy, even putting the abortion issue aside, to have judges who understand their role in that democracy and who do not think that their job is to legislate from the bench. So strict constructionists are good for America no matter what the issue is, but certainly pro-lifers are more excited about them because of where strict constructionists tend to come down on the abortion issue.
Is there any doubt in your mind that abortion is the issue when it comes to who any president in this day and age, the issue when it comes to who any president nominates for the Supreme Court?
None whatsoever. That's the entire debate. That's why we see people getting so inflamed on both sides. And that's why normally reasonable legislators will come up with outrageous attacks against completely qualified nominees, or presidents who are very motivated by this will sometimes put forward nominees who are not qualified, but they hew to the orthodoxy on this issue. It's the most divisive issue in our country, and that's partly because judges were the ones who took this out of the people's hands to decide. And I think that's the sad legacy of Roe v. Wade ever since, is we keep fighting this in the courts when we should be able to debate this as a society and have the power to decide whether we believe in this so-called right to privacy or not.
Do you think that there should be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees?
I think a strict constructionist, as I said, would come to the conclusion that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. And so from the point of view of abortion, as someone who is pro-life, I have utter confidence in that. And so, but my, as I said before, I don't think necessarily you have to have a litmus test on abortion for a judge to come out in that case on that side. I mean, I think it's important to have a strict constructionist. And I think that not only because of the abortion issue, but because of all sorts of other issues that where we're seeing judges taking decisions out of the people's hands and making them for themselves, and that's not their role, and it's really corruptive of our government. And so I think that's the real concern, and I don't think you need to have an abortion litmus test. On the other hand, I think a justice who thinks Roe v. Wade was well decided and well argued, I think, has got a pretty confused judicial philosophy, to say the least.
Folks, in about 15 minutes, I want to hear from you. Same question to you. Do you think that there should be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees? If so, why so? If not, why not? In about 15 minutes, open lines, that's the question for you. Should there be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees? Colleen, Pope Benedict just yesterday pledged to confront the scandal of priestly abuse. What exactly has he promised to do, and what do you expect him to do?
Well, certainly in papal remarks, we don't get a lot of nuts and bolts details like we would a press release of a CEO. And, of course, Pope Benedict is often compared to a CEO of the Catholic Church, but that's not really what his role is. He promised, though, direct action. He mentioned the abuse specifically, and he mentioned his painful visit with the abuse victims in Malta, where he recently traveled. All of this was a welcome change from what we've seen in the last month, which has been silence from the Pope himself on this issue, even as we saw a lot of clumsy attempts by Curia officials to address it. So this is a welcome and good change. I think Catholics and indeed everyone wants to hear more from Pope Benedict himself on this issue. That's certainly what I've been wanting to hear. I was glad to see that he met with those victims. That's a painful, difficult thing to do, and it was right that he did it. And I'm also glad to hear that he's talking about this and that he's pledging direct action. And we know behind the scenes, from all reports, including many of his critics, he has been a driver on trying to reform the church's handling of this problem. But we need to see more of that publicly, and this is a good step in that direction, as is the letter to the Irish Church that he wrote last month, which condemned this in no uncertain terms and admonished the bishops who had covered it up. So these are good steps. The church moves slowly. It's not a modern company, you know, responding with lightning speed and press releases. But I think this is a step in the right direction, and I think Catholics and everyone concerned about this issue should be encouraged by his remarks.
Well, when we come back, I'd like to know the last time that Colleen and I talked about this very issue. She was calling for, not only on these airwaves but in the newspaper, for some righteous anger on the part of Pope Benedict over clergy sexual abuse. I wonder if she thinks she's got it from Pope Benedict yet. Then we'll talk about the treatment of those suffering from dementia and what husbands and fathers can learn from Masters Golf champion Phil Mickelson. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Colleen Carol Campbell of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is our guest.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. on-demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click Listen On Demand.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology. And we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thursday afternoon, April the 22nd, we're coming to you live. Colleen Carol Campbell is our guest. She's a weekly columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of the book The New Faithful, and host of a radio and television program called Faith and Culture. In about 10 minutes, open lines, issues, etc., I want your answer to this question. Should there be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court candidates for the nominees, be they pro-life, pro-choice? Should there be an abortion litmus test for these nominees for the Supreme Court? Yes? Why? No? Why not? I want to hear from you. Give us a call in about 10 minutes. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Email us, talkback at issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. Colleen, when we last talked about the Pope and the clergy sexual abuse scandal, you were calling for some righteous anger from Pope Benedict. Have you seen that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily characterize his most recent remarks as angry. Of course, they were rather brief. But I think the fact that he met with those abuse victims again, and that by all reports he was moved to tears by their stories and showed a lot of resolve in hearing those stories, just as he's shown since he first pored over these records some years ago in 2001 when the documents all sort of flooded his office. I think we are seeing signs that in his own quiet way, he's got some determination to solve this, determination that unfortunately has been lacking among many in the hierarchy. So I'd like to see more, but I think we're moving in the right direction, and I think the sooner those officials who've been more on the side of bashing the media kind of drop that and focus on fixing the problem, the better.
I read what you wrote today on the treatment of those suffering from dementia. This is a personal story for you, isn't it?
Yes, it is. My father battled dementia for 15 years until he died 2 years ago.
And what did you learn in the course of that painful time about how those who have Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia are and should be treated?
Well, it was interesting to watch. You know, in the beginning, before Dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, he was sort of, you know, doing the typical things that can be signs, you know, losing his keys and getting lost behind the wheel, that sort of thing. As time went on, his symptoms got much more pronounced. And eventually, in the last couple of years, my mom was forced to move into a nursing home. She was still taking a daily care of him, but simply couldn't keep him in the home anymore. It was sad in many ways to see how some reacted to it. There were people who came through for him in ways you wouldn't have expected, people who did quiet, good deeds and showed a lot of patience and kindness to him in ways that were really very moving. But unfortunately, especially in the nursing home where he was, there was a very different picture. Often the aides were overworked. There was a very high turnover, and this was considered one of the better nursing homes, which was disconcerting to me as someone who came to see him, you know, several times a week and watched as often, you know, aides would be shouting orders at him as if they thought he were deaf, reporting to me that he was misbehaving that day because he couldn't follow their directions to lift your, you know, left arm up while I put your shirt on, that sort of thing. And there was a lot of just the sense, and this was unfortunately beyond even the nursing home, just the sense in general that there wasn't a need to speak directly to him, to watch your tone of voice, to think about what you say to him because, well, he can't remember anyway. He's not going to remember I came anyway. Why visit? All of these things. And it was interesting that I saw that wasn't the case at all. His cognition was obviously deeply impaired, more so as time went on. But his emotional acuity, his ability to pick up on the emotions in a room and to pick up whether the person caring for him or speaking to him in that moment was doing so out of love or out of haste and irritation, was very strong. He became in some ways even more emotionally sensitive and intuitive than he had been before he got Alzheimer's. And so I saw a real impact that my own visits had, my mother's visits, visits from old friends, the ones who did still come, I saw a real impact and how that could create peace and joy. And you would see that in him even when he couldn't tell you 10 minutes later who had just been there. So I think it's very important to remember that the humanity of the demented person or the person with Alzheimer's disease persists to the very end. And it is not something that disappears as soon as the memory begins to fade.
Tell us briefly about this new University of Iowa study about Alzheimer's type memory loss.
Well, the researchers, it was led by Justin Feinstein, who is a neuropsychology doctoral student. Basically, they took patients who had damaged their hippocampus, which is the same area of the brain that is damaged in Alzheimer's disease. These particular patients had severe amnesia, but same symptoms. They showed them film clips, happy ones and very sad ones, and then they tested them afterward about what they could remember. The average person can remember something like 30 details from one of these clips. These folks, some of them couldn't even remember one detail. But they found that the emotion that the film inspired, whether it be joy, laughter, or intense sorrow, persisted well beyond their memories of the film itself. And the conclusion that the study came to was that we need to pay more attention how we treat patients with Alzheimer's type memory loss, because even though they may not remember the good deeds we did for them or the visit that we paid them, the boost to their mood can last for some time, and it really impacts them the way we treat them, whether or not they can verbally acknowledge that they remember exactly what it is we did for them. So this is, I think, a shot in the arm for caregivers, who, like my mother, often felt that they were doing all these things and sometimes maybe weren't getting the acknowledgement from others outside who to see that this had value. I mean, I think caregivers know that what they're doing for their loved ones with Alzheimer's has value. They can see the impact, but I think we need to give caregivers more support and more encouragement that what you're doing matters. And it matters not just because it's a good deed, but it actually helps this person, even if they can't remember to say thank you.
I really want to recognize my family, my wife. We've been through a lot this year, and it means a lot to share some joy together. She's an incredible wife, an incredible mother, and has been an inspiration for me this past year, seeing what she's been through. And I'm so glad that she and my three kids are here. This has been such an incredible week, emotional week. And to cap it off with this victory, I can't put into words, but it's something that that we'll share and remember the rest of our lives. Thank you.
We've talked before about Tiger Woods, and of course he participated in the Masters recently, came in fourth. What can Tiger learn from the man who came in first, Phil Mickelson?
Well, Phil Mickelson's story was really interesting because he's had a rough year on and off the course because his wife and mother, both in the last year, have been battling breast cancer. And in fact, the Masters was the first time in a while that he was able to have some family with him on tour. She came along with their three children and his parents, but she couldn't even get to the course. She was that weak. I mean, she's been, you know, he's been sort of shepherding her through chemotherapy treatments and all the like. And so, in fact, the night before his victory at the Masters, he was up till 1 a.m. helping his 10-year-old daughter who had broken her wrist while roller skating and needed an emergency x-ray and splint. So it was interesting. He was just a real foil to Tiger Woods in terms of his commitments. So when he won the Masters the next afternoon, and his wife had roused herself out of bed and managed to get there to be there on the 18th hole when he sunk the final putt, all of America, I think, was cheering when we watched that embrace that lasted about 30 seconds, captured on live television, tearful, silent embrace of these spouses. Then he hugged each of his kids, and he dedicated the win to his family, calling his wife incredible, and said that she had been an inspiration for him. It was just a really beautiful story, and I think we don't always see this in sports, but it was really kind of a neat case of a nice guy finishing first. And I think Tiger Woods, certainly he was sort of back to his usual cursing on the course, didn't really say anything in his comments in the press conference about congratulating the victor, just spent more time being pretty defensive about his own attitude and performance. And the last he was seen was speeding off in the back of an SUV, sullen and alone. So I think it's a little bit of a picture, a morality play, maybe you could say, for what life is really like when the glare of the spotlight is gone, and this is who you really are. And I think the fact that Tiger Woods' wife was nowhere to be found, and his personal life is something of a wreck because he spent a lot of time gratifying his own desires rather than being the sort of stand-up family man that you know, marriage calls a man to be. I think it was just good for us to see someone like Phil Mickelson with his story coming out ahead, and I think in a way it gave us a chance to avert our eyes from the Tiger Woods spectacle and look at something inspiring and ennobling for a change, and maybe thank the men in our lives, the family men, who just sort of do the right thing day in and day out and don't get a lot of credit for it.
Colleen Carroll Campbell is a weekly columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, author of the book The New Faithful, host of a radio and television program called Faith and Culture. You can read her columns under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Colleen, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Okay, we were talking about this just a few minutes ago with Colleen, but I want your answer to the question, too. I asked Colleen, does she think there should be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees? What's your answer to that question? It's open lines on the other side of this break. We're coming to you live this Thursday afternoon, the 22nd of April. I want you to answer that question. Should there be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees, not only with respect to President Obama's nominee that he will be making here soon, but any president with any view on abortion? Should there be an abortion litmus test for these nominees for the highest court? Your answer to that question, 1-877-623-6943. I want you to call after the break. Give it some thought. Give me your answer. Get ready to talk about it. 1-877-623-6943. In fact, this break is a great time to call. You can email us with your answer to that question, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Twitter us your answer, @issuesetc, or leave it at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Should there be an abortion litmus test for Supreme Court nominees? Your answer to that question, audio open lines right after this.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen on Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen on Demand page and click Share This.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The Dominican Republic works to protect the unborn.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Legislators in the Dominican Republic have amended the country's constitution to protect unborn babies. Despite some international pressure from pro-abortion groups such as the United Nations and Amnesty International, the National Assembly voted by a large margin to change the Constitution to read, "The right to life is inviolable from conception until death." When the language is officially adopted, the Dominican Republic will join Chile, Guatemala, and Paraguay as Latin American countries who offer unborn children the same rights as other citizens. The constitutional right to life.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.